So this morning we started to look at the Heart Sutra. And the first thing is we looked at the title. And the title in Sanskrit was this Arya Bhagavati Prajna Paramita Hridaya Sutra. So Prajna Paramita, Prajna was wisdom. Paramita can be looked at in two ways at least, in terms of the root parama, which means perfection. So hence, Prajna Paramita is the perfection of wisdom. But also, paramita can be separated. Para means beyond, mita means going or gone. So sometimes Prajna Paramita is talked about in English as the wisdom gone beyond, or the wisdom going to the other shore. And here, of course, going beyond or the other shore, we're talking about the goal of enlightenment, because this is within the Mahayana vehicle. And then the word Hridaya was, again, means essence or heart. So this sutra is the essence or heart of all of the Perfection of Wisdom sutras, meaning containing the meaning in very few words. And then we saw Arya Bhagavati. Bhagavati was the feminine of Bhagavan, which is a epitaph for Buddha, meaning that through following these Prajna Paramita teachings, these teachings on emptiness, we can achieve the goal of enlightenment. We can become an Arya Bhagavan. And the reason, again, there was the feminine TI particle there was to signify that wisdom is considered the feminine aspect of the path, whereas the method side, the upaya side, the compassion side is considered the masculine side of the path. And we've been looking at the prologue. Prologue is, of course, the setting of the sutra. And we saw that was sort of divided into two parts. The first part was what's called the common prologue, which is in common with other sutras, that sutras usually begin describing when it took place, who was teaching, where it took place, and the audience, who was present. And so we saw that in those statements, thus did I hear at one time the Bhagavan was dwelling on massive vultures mountain in Rajgir, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. And then we saw the uncommon prologue, which again is the what's uncommon or unique to this sutra, what was the specific setting to this sutra, and that was that the Bhagavan, the Buddha, was absorbed in this concentration called profound perception, which is meaning he was perceiving the profound. The profound, of course, is emptiness, so he was realizing emptiness, but at the same time he was aware of everything going on around him. And then also we have the Avalokiteshvara, who is the Buddha of compassion, appearing as a high-level bodhisattva, who is also contemplating emptiness, the profound perfection of wisdom. And he was understanding that the five aggregates also were empty of inherent nature. So again, here the five aggregates, as we were looking at before lunch, is one way of categorizing all functional phenomena. But here in particular, the five aggregates presentation, and very commonly within Buddhist teachings, the five aggregates is focusing more on the basis of the person. That the person can be divided into two parts, the body and the mind. And the mind itself can also be further divided into these four aggregates, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, consciousness. And so these five aggregates presentation was often given by the Buddha to help understand that there is no self. There is no single, autonomous, substantial person. That the person is simply a collection of these many things. Hence the word aggregate or skanda. And within this presentation, we see these two mental factors of feeling and discrimination
being taken out of the mental factors and listed separately, for the reason being that both these mental factors are very important and often where we start to go wrong and have problems. Meaning the mental factor of feeling is when we experience things as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and that when we have these pleasant and unpleasant experiences, we often then end up reacting to them with attachment to the pleasant ones and aversion to the unpleasant ones. And also discrimination is our ability to perceive things clearly and accurately, to distinguish things properly and clearly. So again, if we're not seeing things clearly, if we're not discriminating things clearly, if we are projecting all sorts of things and not seeing things clearly, then that's going to lead to often a lot of problems in our behavior and unnecessary suffering. So those two really get a lot of attention. And we're going to be looking at both of those, particularly the first one, feeling, is going to come up a number of times in our discussions. So it said here that Avalokiteshvara was understanding that these five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Now, this word also, as I briefly mentioned, is quite significant here, because what he's saying, what's being said in the sutra, is that the five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature, meaning not only is the person empty of inherent nature, but the basis of the person is also empty of inherent nature. And this is particularly significant because, remember, in the two lower philosophical schools, in the Vaibhashika Sautrantika, which were the basis of the first turning of the wheel, the body and the mind do in fact have inherent nature, that the physical world is made up of these small particles, so it does have some inherent nature, and also the mind has inherent nature, and that it's only the person that we overinflate. So this is sort of indicating that not only are we grasping onto self, but we are grasping onto the body and the mind as having some inherent nature when they in fact don't. So this is, and also this word also is sort of implying, you know, that not only the person, but also the body and the mind are empty of inherent nature. This is also sort of implying the order in which we investigate these things in our practice, as we're going to see later in the Heart Sutra, is that first, when it comes to investigating the nature of reality, it's often recommended that we start with person, me the person, then the body and mind, in this order. So that's also the word also is also sort of indicating this. What this word inherent nature really means, we're of course going to look at in quite a lot of detail. So this is the setting, the prologue for the sutra. So we're going to now actually look at the actual subject matter, of the actual sutra now. So let's go there, which is into the next paragraph, which says, "Then, through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, 'How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom?'" So there's a couple of important things to talk about here in this paragraph. First it says, "Then, through the power of Buddha." So what does that mean? So remember, a sutra is a discourse of the Buddha. It's what's called the words of the Buddha.
So when we talk about sutras or the words of the Buddha, we can talk about them in three ways, or there are three types of words of the Buddha. The first, of course, and the most simple to understand, is things that are directly spoken by the Buddha. Then we can have words that are spoken on behalf of the Buddha. And an example of this in this particular sutra is the prologue. These two paragraphs we've covered, of course the Buddha never spoke these words. These were added later by, again, the normal assertion is Ananda, to recount the circumstances where this discourse took place. So these first two paragraphs, the prologue, would be within this, spoken on behalf of the Buddha. And the third type is directly inspired by the Buddha. And actually, most of this sutra comes into this category, is that these words here, it says, through the power of Buddha. What that means is, through the power of the concentration or the mind of the Buddha, he is inspiring Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra to have the following discussion. So that's what this means, is directly inspired by the Buddha. So that he's really orchestrating this conversation between Shariputra and Avalokiteshvara. And that covers most of this sutra. In the first category, the words actually spoken by the Buddha is very few in this particular sutra. We have to go right down towards the end of the sutra where the Buddha says, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that. It is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom, just as you've indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. So it's only that one sentence that actually was directly spoken by the Buddha. Then the majority of the sutra falls into the third category. So when we talk about the words of the Buddha or sutras, they can be in any one of those three categories. Okay? So that's what it means by through the power of Buddha is the third one.
So, Arya Avalokiteshvara, he's a Buddha of compassion. Is it the Buddha you're referring to, Gautam Buddha, or some other Buddha?
No, it's Shakyamuni Buddha is Gautam Buddha. Gautam was the family name. So,
Buddha of compassion, when you say it's just one of the aspects of Shakyamuni Buddha?
No.
I'm a little confused. Buddha of compassion.
Yeah. So, what we need to understand here, of course, is even how the life of Prince Siddhartha and Shakyamuni Buddha can be interpreted. So, of course, within the Theravada traditions, generally it's said that Prince Siddhartha was just a normal person and he did all this practice, he became enlightened, and that when his body passed away, that's it, he would never come back. And as far as I'm aware, he's the only Buddha in this recent age that has become enlightened, according to Theravada tradition. In the Mahayana tradition, particularly now talking within the Tibetan Buddhism, generally it's sort of accepted that even the life of Prince Siddhartha was a display, that this person was already enlightened, and that he was appearing to be this prince and achieving enlightenment to show people how to achieve enlightenment. And that also when Shakyamuni Buddha, when this body passed away, then he is still continuing to manifest and appear in the world
even today. And that therefore also there are many other enlightened beings around as well. One of those would be Avalokiteshvara. So it depends a little bit on your interpretations of these situations. But to the audience at least, Avalokiteshvara was appearing just as a high-level bodhisattva. And even now when we come to talk about Shariputra, then there are different sort of assertions as what level that he was at. But it seems like in the sutra he was appearing in a certain way, at least to the audience. What Shariputra's actual level was, there is some discussion about. But as we're going to see in the sutra, he's really sort of appearing in the form of an arhat to the audience.
The other question was, since it is a sutra, and sutra are pretty uniform in the sense, as soon as the Buddha attained Parinirvana, there was a community or a gathering of monks who just had formalized all the sutras. So it should be same in Theravada as well as Mahayana.
See, the thing is that the teachings that spread most widely were from the first turning of the wheel. And so it's those sutras that were gathered together in these councils. And these were transmitted through the Pali language to other countries. So in those sutras, you won't find the Heart Sutra because it's not part of that first turning of the wheel. Therefore, often you find that some Theravada practitioners would even say that these sorts of sutras the Buddha never taught, because they don't appear in the Pali canon. So, of course, there's a lot of discussion about this as well. Okay. So this is what is the words of the Buddha, and that's what's meant by this statement here, then through the power of the Buddha, meaning through the power of the Buddha's mind or his concentration, he is inspiring Shariputra and Avalokiteshvara to have this conversation. So who is Shariputra? I don't think we've got a picture here. Often when you see a picture or a painting of the Buddha, often you see two disciples, one on either side standing up. These are the two main disciples of Buddha, and one of those is Shariputra, and the other one is Moggallana. And it's said that Shariputra was the disciple who had the best understanding of the wisdom, and that Moggallana had a good ability in terms of the clairvoyant capabilities of reading other minds and so forth. And here the word Shariputra, putra means child or son, and Shari is actually the mother's name. So Shariputra means the son of Shari. And here we see the word venerable. Often the word venerable is used in terms of a sign of respect from younger monks to more elder monks. But here the word venerable is not that word. It's a different word that is being translated in the same English word venerable. The word here, in Tibetan is literally se den. Se means life. Den means possessing. So this, what has been translated as venerable here, is really what it means literally possessing life. And when we look at what it means by possessing life, it means to possess a life free of the afflictions. So who is free of the afflictions is the arhat. So the word venerable here is indicating that Shariputra, at least to the audience, was appearing to be an arhat. And it says here, Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara: how should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? So, son of the lineage, what does that mean? This word lineage is coming from the Sanskrit word gotra. And usually or very often within Mahayana teachings, when we talk about lineage, we're really talking about what's called naturally abiding lineage, which is another name for Buddha nature. That we all have this Buddha nature, therefore we can all become enlightened. So that's usually what this word gotra or naturally abiding lineage is referring to. But here, it's not referring to that. Here when it says son of the lineage, it's talking about these three lineages of practice. Remember we talked about the Shravaka, Pratika Buddha, and the Bodhisattva. These three lineages. So when he's talking about son of the lineage, we're talking about the third one, the Bodhisattva. Or sometimes it's simply called Mahayana lineage. So when someone is referred to as a son or daughter or child of the lineage, we're talking about someone who's activated their Mahayana lineage. What does it mean to have activated the Mahayana lineage? It means that we have developed great compassion and we are starting to aspire to follow the Mahayana path to enlightenment. So that's what it means to be a son or daughter of the lineage. That at least we have developed great compassion and we are aspiring to follow the Mahayana path. And the question is, how should any son of the lineage, and again, I think why he's using the word son here is because he's really talking about himself. You know, Shariputra is a man, of course. So he's really talking about himself. You know, how should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? So, of course, the profound perfection of wisdom is the wisdom of emptiness supported by bodhicitta. So what this question really means very simply is, how should someone train, let's say again, how should someone who has developed great compassion train if they want to practice or train in this wisdom of emptiness? So that's really what the question is saying. So this is what Shariputra is asking to Avalokiteshvara. Is there anything, any questions about any of that in that paragraph or sentence? Yeah.
First one is, when you talk about the words of the Buddha, and Avalokiteshvara himself is a Buddha, but he's appearing as a Bodhisattva. So even, I mean, not really the setting of the heart, but otherwise, even his words are the words of the Buddha.
When it says the words of the Buddha, we're talking about the sutras attributed to Shakyamuni Buddha. Of course, according to Mahayana, certainly, there are many enlightened beings. But when we talk about sutras or the words of the Buddha, we're talking about the historical Shakyamuni Buddha.
Yeah, there are many Buddhas.
Well, again, within the Mahayana, yes. I mean, I think generally in the Theravada, they wouldn't accept that. That there's only really been the one historical Buddha. Maybe they also talk about earlier eras, there were other Buddhas, but in the current world age, I think in most Theravada traditions, they accept there's only been one, the Shakyamuni Buddha. Whereas in the Mahayana, of course, many.
Even Shariputra is appearing as an arhat.
Yeah, so again, I think often within what I've seen, at least in Tibetan tradition, when they comment on this, often I find that the Tibetan commentators often say that Shariputra was also some very high-level bodhisattva. But that's just an interpretation. So, of course, everything's open to interpretation. But at least in the perspective of the audience, he really does appear to be an arhat. And if, I think within the Theravada traditions, generally they would accept that he was, in fact, an arhat.
So the implication is that an arahat doesn't have the perfection of wisdom.
Yeah. So this is a very good point. Is remember the two first philosophical schools based on the Four Noble Truths teachings. Those philosophical schools, there's not really any taught teachings about emptiness. There's only this idea of no self. So according to those philosophical schools, to achieve nirvana, you just have to realize no self, selflessness. And so for them, if you'd realize that, you can become an arhat. From the Mahayana perspective, that's not possible. That if you really merely realize this no self, you won't really become an arhat. It'll be very helpful to subdue a lot of mental afflictions. But even to become an arhat, a real arhat, according to the Mahayana, you need to realize this wisdom of emptiness. Which is actually interesting in that in those first philosophical schools, I think particularly in the Vaibhashika, they say, I've read in the text, the tenets there, that sometimes they talk about these six types of arhat. The first five are ones that actually can fall back into samsara. And it's only the sixth that doesn't. And so from a Mahayana perspective, that's because these people were not really arhats to begin with. They just managed to, through their selflessness experience, managed to subdue the mental afflictions for some time. So it appeared like they were free of all the mental afflictions, but then slowly they reasserted themselves. So then they appeared to fall back into samsara. But again, from the Mahayana perspective, they were never really free in the first place. So that's why, you know, that perhaps a lot of the people in the audience were following these earlier teachings and thought that, you know, we can achieve nirvana through selflessness. And that's why Shariputra, to them, is appearing as an arhat, appears to be someone who's realized his selflessness, yet he's asking this Avalokiteshvara, you know, how do I practice this wisdom of emptiness thing in that way? Okay. Let's now look at Avalokiteshvara's response. And we can see here, using the benefit of these outlines that have been inserted, that the answer is divided into a number of sections. And actually, to make it more clear, if we flip over the page to this sort of mind map over here, it becomes more obvious. If we look in Avalokiteshvara's response here, the first part, it says this is responding to someone of inferior faculties, which actually just means to the normal person, actually. But, so the normal answer, you can see, is divided into four. It says path of accumulation and preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, path of no more learning, which are the stages along the Mahayana path to enlightenment. So we can see that Avalokiteshvara's answer to Shariputra is, how do we practice this wisdom of emptiness along the various stages of the path to enlightenment? And these stages of the path to enlightenment can be seen on that Mahayana path chart below here. So if we just have a brief look at this, I want to just give a little overview of this before we actually go back into the Heart Sutra. So if we look at the Mahayana path chart, we see that it's sort of divided into five stages, or sometimes called the five paths. So we see there the path of accumulation, path of preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, and path of no more learning. And so these are the stages we go through on the way to enlightenment. And so if we go back towards the beginning, down the bottom, we see number two. It says uncontrived renunciation bodhicitta. So this, remember, bodhicitta is based on renunciation. So when we really develop this uncontrived bodhicitta, this aspiration for enlightenment, we enter the Mahayana path and we become a bodhisattva.
And so that entry point, the first stage of the path, is called this path of accumulation. Now, before that, we see number one, before the entry point, and it says, inferential realization of emptiness, sharp faculty trainees. Which means that someone with very sharp faculties, before they really fully develop bodhicitta, can investigate this nature of reality and can come to have this, what's called inferential realization of emptiness, even before entering the Mahayana path. So this brings up the point of the stages that we go through in our understanding and cultivation of emptiness. And we can talk about three stages that we go through in our understanding and cultivation of emptiness. And I like to use the Tibetan words because they're very short and very sort of, I don't know, descriptive. In Tibetan, it's Go Nyam Tok. Go means intellectual understanding. So, of course, the first thing we need to do is to gain an intellectual understanding. You know, we listen to some teachings, maybe we read some books as well, we contemplate, we think about this, and then we come to some intellectual understanding of emptiness, the view of reality. Because we need this as a framework for our meditation practice. If we don't have this, then we have no framework for practice. We won't know how to practice. And if we have some sort of experience in practice, we won't know how to interpret that. Is that valid or not? Or am I just spacing out? What should I do with that? So the first stage is we need to develop this intellectual understanding. And of course, in this course, we're trying to start to do that a little bit. I'm trying to explain a little bit about emptiness. We're trying to think about that and ask some questions and reflect on that. But of course, intellectual understanding, just that, is not really going to dramatically change our life. Again, as I mentioned earlier, we all have an intellectual understanding of impermanence. We learnt that at school. Science has proven it. I think we all can intellectually appreciate that things are changing moment by moment. But that intellectual understanding of impermanence, I think, is not really helping us much in our daily life, not benefiting us much. We're still grasping after things, trying to hold on to them, wanting to stay things to last. So our experience or the way we behave seems to be opposite to our intellectual understanding. It's because our intellectual understanding is not driving our behavior. Our behavior is driven by our instinctive habits. And our instinctive habits are telling us that things have some stability, they sort of last a little while at least. And so therefore we try and hold on to them, if particularly they give us pleasure. So if we can even bring our intellectual understanding of impermanence into experience through meditation and experientially see the world as in this constant flow, then we wouldn't have all this grasping to things because there's nothing really to grasp. So an experience of impermanence will, in fact, help us dramatically in our daily life. Likewise, of course, emptiness. Is that we can have a very good intellectual understanding of emptiness. That in itself probably is not going to dramatically change our life. We need to go to the next step and meditate. And that's where Nyam comes in. Nyam means
means taste or experience.
So we sit down, we try to meditate on this emptiness based on our understanding, and we may have some little experience of emptiness in meditation, a little taste of it. But because our mind is not very calm, clear, focused, that little taste or experience doesn't really penetrate very far. And in fact, even directly after meditation, we may not have any residual effect at all. But if that taste or experience was a little bit stronger, we may notice that that experience of emptiness may have some residual effect after the meditation. It may still affect our mind for some minutes, hours, days, sometimes even a few weeks. And during that time that it's affecting our mind, we are seeing reality in a more correct way, which means that you'll find that during that period, you'll feel much more peaceful and calm, you'll feel more connected with others, and you'll find that the mental afflictions, it's more difficult to get angry, irritated, to have craving. It's much more difficult for those to come up. But that will slowly, slowly wear off as our habits reassert themselves. So that's usually the first stage when we start to meditate. But of course we need to go more than that because this is not very stable and it only will help us for those very brief periods. And then we're going to go back to our normal habits. So we need to go to the next stage of practice, which is talk, which is realization. And realization has a more stable and lasting impact. For that to happen, of course, we need a very stable, clear, focused mind. To really realize emptiness, we need shamatha. If we have less than shamatha, our mind is not stable enough to penetrate fully, which means that at best, we'll have this. And it could be quite a strong experience, and it may have a good positive impact for some hours or days, but it will wear off. So we need to move to the next level, and that is realization. Now, here we're talking about emptiness. We're talking about there is no independent me, no independent objective world. And another way of expressing that sometimes is no duality, which means that when we come to realize emptiness directly, that experience is a non-dualistic, a completely non-conceptual experience. But before that, as a stage before that, we have what's called conceptual realization. So realization here comes in two stages. And that's what this word inferential here means. Inferential realization is conceptual. So we start to meditate. We may have some little experience of emptiness. It wears off. Then we work on our shamatha practice and our mind really becomes very stable, clear and focused. And then we can have a conceptual realization of emptiness. And so a conceptual realization of emptiness is in that experience, there's still a sense of me, the meditator, experiencing this thing emptiness. So there's still this subject-object duality in the experience. Whereas the non-conceptual direct realization of emptiness, in that experience, there's no longer a sense of me, the meditator, or emptiness, the object.
There's simply the experience of emptiness. And so this is the sequence that we go through. Now, these five paths, it's talking about someone who can have this inferential realization of emptiness before even entering the path of accumulation. So this is someone who has really developed this shamatha and is having this conceptual realization of emptiness. Because if they have this realization of emptiness, this is a valid mind, this confirms to this person that, in fact, enlightenment is possible. And so, therefore, they will put a lot of effort, of course, into the Mahayana path. So for some trainees, they would first have this experience of emptiness, then develop bodhicitta. For others, they would first develop bodhicitta and then really develop this conceptual realization of emptiness. But what this is implying here is that to enter the path of accumulation, we already need a very stable mind. Because to really have what's called uncontrived bodhicitta, this is also very stable bodhicitta. So this also needs the mind of shamatha to have that stability. So, therefore, when we talk about these stages according to these paths, the first two stages, path of accumulation and preparation, there will be a conceptual realization of emptiness. Whereas the path of seeing, the word seeing, means seeing emptiness directly. So by the time we get to the path of seeing, we're having a direct realization. And then, of course, the following is also direct, path of meditation. So Avalokiteshvara's answer is telling us how to practice this wisdom of emptiness on those four, well, including the final stage, but particularly these four stages of the spiritual path. But of course, we as a beginner might be a little bit somewhere before that. And therefore, to really have a realization, we need to develop this stable, clear mind. Otherwise, we'll just have some little taste, it'll wear off, and we won't get very far. Which means that we really need to work on the shamatha practice. And of course, as we saw in the three vehicles, the three core areas of practice were ethics, concentration, wisdom. Ethics is the basis, then the shamatha and vipassana practices. So all the vehicles, all the traditions say that these are three things very important. But unfortunately, it seems like in many of the traditions, both Mahayana and Theravada, when it comes down to actual practice, the concentration part of it seems to get left out a lot. You know, we often see in a lot of traditions, vipassana, vipassana, vipassana. In the Tibetan tradition, they often talk about, you know, emptiness, bodhicitta, deity yoga, all these practices, which are good, but if you don't have any shamatha basis, we're not going to get very far. Like everything in life, if we have no ability to concentrate, then we're not effective in anything we do. So to really make our emptiness practice much more effective, of course we need a very stable, clear, focused mind. If we have this, you'll find that the vipassana practice, emptiness practice, also the bodhicitta practice, all practices will become much more effective. They'll penetrate much more deeply. Otherwise, we sit down and meditate and we do our tong len and we do our emptiness and sort of something happens and then after meditation there's no effect because our mind was thinking about breakfast or we were half asleep. So what I'd like to do now
is spend a little bit of time talking about the shamatha practice, because I think it's something that's very important. And not only is it essential as a basis for not only emptiness practice but all other practices, but also the shamatha practice itself directly brings huge benefits to us, particularly in our modern day society where we really have this sort of epidemic of ADHD, you know, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And, you know, all these sort of mobile phones and iPads and Facebook and everything is an absolute disaster when it comes to developing a stable, clear mind. Even some modern studies have shown these things are a complete disaster, that our attention skills are going like this, and that younger generation have less and less attention skills, much more ADHD than before. So I think it's important that we put a little bit of time and effort into this shamatha practice. So that's what I'd like to do now. But before I go there, I just want to briefly summarize this path, have a look at this in very briefly, because in our answer of the Heart Sutra, we're going to go through the various stages in Avalokiteshvara's response. So it's good to understand what each of these stages is a little bit about. So I'd like to spend just 10 or 15 minutes now talking about some of these things. And then when we go to that part of the path later in the text, we'll dive into it a little bit more deeply. So again, this is the Mahayana path, the path to enlightenment. And as we've seen, to enter the Mahayana path, we need this uncontrived renunciation and bodhicitta. So there, we can also lay out something very similar to this, the Theravada path to Nirvana. And so the entry point, of course, to the Theravada path is renunciation. When we've developed this aspiration for liberation, uncontrived, then we've entered the Buddhist path in general. But on top of that, if we develop uncontrived bodhicitta, we enter the Mahayana path. Now, this word here, it says path of accumulation. The word accumulation here is talking about accumulating the two aspects of the path. Remember, we talked about method and wisdom. And often here, we talk about the, sometimes it's called the two accumulations or the two collections. And there, they often talk about merit and wisdom. Merit and wisdom. And merit, of course, is simply the imprints or the results of our virtuous actions. So what we need to do, of course, is to basically accumulate. We need to engage in a lot of virtuous actions, and we need to, of course, develop our wisdom. So again, this is really reflecting the two aspects of wisdom and compassion. So on this stage of the path, we are doing both of those. Of course, we're meditating on emptiness, and we're doing a lot of virtuous activities. And again, on the path of accumulation, we have already developed shamatha, which means our mind is very stable and clear. And when we meditate on emptiness, we are having this conceptual realization of emptiness. Not direct, but this conceptual realization of emptiness, because it's based on shamatha, is quite stable. Which means that after the meditation, that conceptual realization of emptiness is strong enough to sort of keep the lid on the mental afflictions. Because that's affecting our mind after the meditation, you'll find that the mental afflictions such as craving and jealousy and anger and hatred, it's very difficult for them to come up. And if they do come up, they're very weak and they last a very short time. What do you mean by part of the Mahayana path?
I don't know. Where does it
in Shaman Bad course a few days ago, and a friend, she's doing she's following a lot of teaching, and she came to your course, and she was very confused. She said, you know, my teacher says, no, I should first have more accumulation before doing shamatha. So...
Of course, we're not saying that before the path of accumulation, we're not doing this. We need to do that from the very beginning. And so... See, this is where it's helpful to have a qualified teacher, because, of course, to do any practice, we need good conditions, and we need to have positive state of mind. And I think this is what this person is referring to, that if we have a lot of negativity in our mind, if we don't have much positive energy in our mind through doing virtuous actions, then when we try to sit down and focus on the breath, our mind will be disturbed and nothing will work. So there, it would be useful to put a lot of effort into, that's why ethics is the basis. No? It's ethics, concentration, wisdom. So I think this person is referring to, we need that good ethical basis. That if we've come into practice quite unethical, a lot of disturbed mind and so forth, and we try to sit down and meditate on our breath, this is going to be almost impossible. So therefore we need to clean up our mind a little bit, make our mind not so agitated, disturbed and full of negativities to even begin the shamatha practice well. So I think this is being referring to the ethical basis. Yeah. Now, where do we first develop shamatha on this path? Again, there's slight differences of opinion here, but most commentators would say that to even have this uncontrived bodhicitta, we need shamatha. Some other commentators say, well, you don't really need shamatha to do that, but they say you have to be very close. So either way, to enter the first part of the path, we either have to have shamatha or something very close. That's the general assertion. Uncontrived means... it's natural and spontaneous. Now, of course...
You haven't made a decision.
Yeah. So now... Yeah. So now, of course, we can go through these reflections we looked at yesterday, and we can bring up this through our reflections and contemplation. We can then come to a conclusion or a point where we say, oh, I really want to achieve enlightenment to help others. I really want to do that. And we can have a little taste of that. That's contrived. Because we have to think about it to generate it. But if we keep doing that, particularly with a stable, clear mind, that taste of bodhicitta penetrates and it becomes spontaneous, meaning that the uncontrived bodhicitta is that this aspiration of bodhicitta is continuously surfacing in us in all of our activities in daily life. We don't have to sit down and think about it to really generate it. It's so familiar to us that it's spontaneously and continuously motivating all of our behavior in daily life. That's what it means to be uncontrived. Okay. Then we have path of preparation. Here the word preparation means we're preparing for our first direct realization of emptiness. So at this stage, the realization of emptiness is still conceptual, but what we notice over this path, part of the path, is this apparent duality between me, the meditator, and emptiness, the object that seems to be there, this duality that seems to be there, starts to collapse. And right at the end of the path of meditation, it completely collapses. And then we enter the path of seeing, and then our realization of emptiness becomes completely non-conceptual, direct. There's no sense of me, the meditator, and emptiness, the object, in the experience. There's just the experience of emptiness. So if you're sitting there and you're thinking, oh, I'm having a direct realization of emptiness, 100% certain you're not. That's impossible. So path of seeing means direct realization. Now the realization of emptiness is powerful enough to start to wipe out the mental afflictions and ignorance. Before that, on the path of accumulation and preparation, because it was conceptual, it was only strong enough to keep the lid on the mental afflictions, to really stop them from coming up very much. So we haven't wiped them out yet. We're just sort of keeping the lid on them. From the path of seeing onwards, because it's a direct realization of emptiness, we're now starting to wipe out mental afflictions and ignorance. But one direct realization of emptiness is not enough to eliminate all mental afflictions and ignorance. That's why on the path of meditation, we need to continue to meditate in terms of continuing to directly realize emptiness again and again and again and again and again, wiping out more and more ignorance, mental afflictions. And we see that the path of seeing and meditation here are divided into these 10 steps called the 10 grounds, or in Sanskrit, the 10 bhumis. And we see that when we move along the path of meditation, when we get to the end of the 7th ground, we have wiped out all ignorance and mental afflictions, these afflictive obscurations. So we see number 9 there, which is nirvana. So by the time we got to the 7th, end of the 7th stage, or the 7th ground, we have achieved nirvana. We've eliminated all of our mental afflictions and ignorance. But since we're on the Mahayana path, where goal is enlightenment, we still have to get rid of these things called the cognitive obscurations we see down in the bottom right-hand corner. And I'll be explaining what they are in more detail later. But simply here, we can say cognitive obscurations are very subtle stains in our mind, very difficult to get rid of. And we get rid of those over the last 3 grounds, 8, 9, and 10. And then at the end of the 10th ground, we wipe out the last subtle stain in our mind. And the next moment, we end up in the enlightened state, which is called the path of no more learning. So that is when we've become enlightened, we've become a Buddha. So that is very quickly and briefly the 5 stages of the path. Again, as we go through the answer from Avalokiteshvara, we're going to look at each one of those 5 stages in more detail. So again, it's just a quick overview at the moment. Any questions, simple questions about that before we go for afternoon tea break? Anything that's not clear or confusing in that chart? Again, we're going to look at it in more detail later. So if there's something that's confusing now, then yeah.
These chunks of uninterrupted path, liberated path?
I'll talk about that later. Anything else that's not sort of clear or completely confusing from the chart?
Does mindfulness is the same that is sometimes referred to as different levels of bodhisattva?
Yes. Usually when we talk about bodhisattvas, often they're talking about the Arya bodhisattva, of course, which is someone from the path of seeing onwards. And then we talk about the 10 grounds. So often when they talk about the different levels of bodhisattvas, they're often talking about at being at those one of those 10 levels. You know. And it's said that in the Heart Sutra that Avalokiteshvara to the audience is appearing as a 10th ground bodhisattva. That's often the assertion. So often when we talk about levels of bodhisattvas, normally they're talking about these 10 grounds. But not exclusively, but often, you know, at what level is the bodhisattva at? Usually it's these 10 grounds they're talking about.
Just a question, like you say number 9 is nirvana and arahat, so that means that the Theravada practice, when you come in arahat, you disappear.
You disappear? Again, it depends who you talk to. Within the Theravada tradition, the assertion is that when you become an arhat, of course, as soon as you become an arhat, you don't disappear into a puff of smoke. You've still got this body. And you go around helping others as much as you can. But at the end of this life, when this body collapses, then it's said within the Theravada tradition, you never come back again. And then you ask them, well, what happens? They say, well, you end up in this inexpressible state. I can't express it because it's beyond conception. But often, see, the word for nirvana, or is it nirvana or another Sanskrit word, and it literally means the sort of blowing out, going out, extinguishing, which means this body and mind we have now is sort of blown out. Again, what that means, what's left, again, not really anything. From the Mahayana perspective, this is a little bit illogical, this idea. And so from the Mahayana perspective, even if we're on the path, our goal is nirvana, and this body then collapses at the end of the life, we don't get extinguished. That because our goal was nirvana, then we end up in that state. We end up in what's called a mental body, this mental sphere of peace. But it's a state of peace where you're totally disconnected from the rest of the universe. You're isolated in this peace. Very peaceful and blissful. But according to the Mahayana, because it's not the final goal, it's a temporary state. And the person who ends up in that state will eventually pop out of that and understand they're not finished the journey yet. And then they will take another form, not in samsara, of course, and continue on to enlightenment. This is the Mahayana perspective. Okay, tea time, afternoon tea. So let's have a cup of tea, have a break, come back at 3:30, and then I really want to talk a little bit about this shamatha practice.